Well, I don't need to tell you that quantum theory is over 100 years old now, but some of the deep ways in which quantum systems are different from classical systems we've really only begun to understand in the last couple of years. We're accustomed to the idea that quantum mechanics is weird, but lately we've been trying to ask whether it's possible to put the weirdness to work, whether there are tasks we can perform in a quantum world that wouldn't be possible in a classical world. And that challenge of putting the weirdness to work is driving the emergence of a new field of science, quantum information science, which from a theorist's perspective, I think derives much of its intellectual vitality from three central themes, the ideas of quantum computing, quantum cryptography, and quantum error correction. Quantum computing is the idea that if we process quantum states instead of classical bits, we can perform tasks that wouldn't be possible with ordinary digital computers. So, for example, finding the 65-digit prime factors of this 130-digit composite number is a hard problem for today's supercomputers, but for a quantum computer, it would be an easy problem, not much harder than multiplying two numbers together to find their product. Well, the second important theme is quantum cryptography, that if in cryptographic protocols we use quantum states, rather than classical bits, we can achieve unconditional security. So specifically in the case of key exchange, the privacy of communication can be founded on principles of fundamental physics rather than assumptions about the resources available to a potential adversary. And the third key theme is quantum error correction, that if quantum states are cleverly encoded, they can be protected from damage and processed in a fault-tolerant manner. And it's the development of quantum error correction that makes us believe that large-scale quantum computers might really be possible. Physicists are fond of saying that it's possible to prepare a quantum state of a cat, which is a coherent superposition of the live state and the dead state. We don't see such states, and the reason is that no real cat can be perfectly isolated from its surroundings, and interactions with the environment will, in effect, immediately measure the cat, projecting it onto the state which is completely dead or completely alive. A quantum computer might not be quite as complicated as a cat, but like a cat, it would interact with the environment, which would cause decoherence and the decay of the quantum information that's encoded in it. And it's only because we've learned in principle how to protect quantum information from decoherence and other errors that we have some confidence that large-scale quantum computers are possible. But it's not going to be easy. Here are two information processing systems. How are they different from one another? Well, the system on the left is built from very unreliable components. So in order for it to function at all, it needs to incorporate into its design a hierarchy of error correction systems from the DNA on up. And the system on the right is built from much more reliable components, so error correction is a less important element in its design. In some ways, at least as we currently envision it, a quantum computer will be more like System A than System B. Much of the processing that it'll be doing will be for the purpose of preventing the decay of the information that it holds rather than propelling the computation forward to the next step. So what I'd like to do in the talk is first of all give about a 15-minute course in quantum error correction and fault tolerance. And then in the second half, I'd like to indicate how topological ideas can help to guide us toward quantum computing designs that are intrinsically robust. So first of all, if we're going to talk about error correction, we should understand what errors are. So let's imagine I have n qubits of data, N2-level systems that I want to be able to protect from damage. An error acting on that system can be described as a unitary transformation that acts on the data and on its environment. And that transformation can be expanded in terms of some basis for linear operators acting on the data. A convenient choice of basis is the Pauli operators, where each element of the basis EA is a tensor product of the identity and the three Pauli matrices X, Y, and Z. That is, in each one of these operators, acting on each of the qubits is either the identity or one of the Pauli operators X, Y, or Z. And associated with each one of these errors is some corresponding state of the environment, which we're not assuming here are mutually orthogonal or normalized states. And our goal is to reverse the damage, to undo this procedure, so that we can recover the original undamaged state psi, which is a quantum state that we don't know. Well, we can't expect to succeed for arbitrary errors, but maybe we have a chance that the errors are of a restricted type. And in particular, on physical grounds, it's reasonable to expect that because the environment interacts with the system locally, that the errors won't be very highly correlated among the different qubits. So with that in mind, suppose we define the weight of a Pauli operator as the number of qubits on which it acts non-trivially, with the identity acting on the rest. If errors are relatively rare and not too strongly correlated, then the typical Pauli operators that occur in this expansion will have relatively low weight. And so what we can seek to do is reverse the damage only in the case of those low weight operators. The remaining part that we can't fix will hopefully have a small amplitude since it involves large weight Pauli operators. So our recovery procedure can also be described as a unitary transformation, which acts both on the data and some additional system, an ancilla, which we introduced for the purpose of doing error correction. And we'd like to choose that transformation so it has the property that for Pauli operators that we want to be able to reverse, acting on this state, it allows us to recover the state psi, in the process doing something to the ancilla. And if it can do that for all the Pauli operators up to weight t, we'll say we have a code that can correct t errors for some t less than n in the block of n data qubits. So altogether, the way this procedure works is an error is introduced, which in general will produce entanglement between the data and the environment. And we can't undo the fact that the environment has become entangled with something, but we can perform a recovery operation which will transform entanglement of the data with the environment into entanglement of the environment with the ancilla. And then that, in effect, takes the entropy introduced into the data by the errors, pumps it to the ancilla, where we can, in principle, dispose of it, in fact, reintroducing the entropy back into the environment. So our error correction procedure is really a kind of refrigerator that takes entropy introduced by errors, pumps it to our ancilla, and eventually back to the surroundings. Well, we're not going to be able to succeed in reversing the errors for arbitrary quantum states at the n qubits, but maybe we have a chance if we restrict the states to some code subspace of the n qubit Hilbert space. If that code subspace has dimension 2 to the k, then we'll say we have k encoded protected qubits embedded in the block of n qubits. So how can we design a code? Well, one way that works, something sufficient but not necessary, is we can choose our code subspace to have the property that for all of the Pauli operators that we want to be able to reverse, the code subspace, when acted on by that operator, is taken to one of a set of mutually orthogonal spaces. And then in principle, we can perform an incomplete orthogonal measurement that tells us in which of these spaces the state lies. And once we've identified which Pauli operator is acted on the state, since that is a unitary operator, we can apply its inverse, and that's how we undo the damage. So here's an example of a code which has a 5-qubit code block and one protected qubit embedded in the block, which has the ability to correct one error in any position, acting on any one of the 5 qubits. The way it works is the code space is the simultaneous eigenspace of a set of commuting operators, all of which are Pauli operators, tensor products of Pauli matrices. They're actually commuting so they can be simultaneously diagonalized. So we can choose our code space to be the space in which each one of these 4 operators, M1 through M4, has the value +1. Those operators have been chosen so that each one of the errors that we want to be able to protect against, which can be an X, a Y, or a Z acting on any one of the 5 qubits, each one of those changes the eigenvalues of the operators M1 through M4 in distinguishable ways. So in principle, we can imagine measuring these 4 operators, M1 through M4, obtaining outcomes which are +1 or -1, and then we can look at our table. If we got the outcome ++++ for the measurement of the 4 operators, that points to a unique error, which is a Z acting on the 2nd qubit. And then we can apply a Z to the 2nd qubit to reverse the damage. So as long as we didn't have more than one error in the block, we can recover from the damage. The measurements provide us with a syndrome that points to a particular error of the type that we want to be able to reverse. So you can see, in order for error correction to be performed in this way, we have to have the ability to measure these commuting multi-qubit operators. How do we do that? Well, we can do it if we have a quantum computer, at least in principle. I can imagine introducing an ancilla in this state, which is the coherent superposition of two orthogonal states called 0 and 1, and then conditionally applying the operator that we want to measure, one of these, to the code block, that is, applying the identity if the ancilla is in the state 0 and applying M if the ancilla is in the state 1. And that will take this state to one of the two orthogonal states, 0 plus or minus 1, depending on whether the value of M is plus 1 or minus 1. So by measuring in that basis, we can determine the value of M. And we can perform that for each one of these four operators to find our error syndrome. And that conditional operation can be constructed as a quantum circuit built from two qubit gates where the Pauli operators X or Z are applied to qubits in the code block conditioned on the value of the ancilla. Okay? So that's the basic idea of quantum error correcting codes and error recovery. As we examine it in more detail, we find that there are some subtleties that deserve attention because things can go wrong when we carry out the procedure, and we want to make sure it remains effective even when flaws occur during the recovery procedure. When we measure a syndrome, of course, something could go wrong and we could get the wrong answer. The procedure might propagate errors from one qubit to many other qubits, which would cause serious damage. So far, I've only talked about error correction, but we also want to process protected data, so we have to have some way of implementing a universal set of gates that act on the encoded states. And we're going to need codes that can protect not just against one error in the block, but against many errors in a block in order to perform a long computation reliably. So here's an example of the type of error propagation problem that we might worry about. We want to measure this for qubit operator by executing a quantum circuit. And in the midst of our computation, an error might occur in the ancilla introduced by the environment. And then subsequent gates can propagate that error to the data. So in this case, a single error introduced by the environment actually resulted in two errors in the data because our procedure has been badly designed and we need to improve it. Well, I won't discuss in detail how that's done, but the problem of controlling error propagation in both error recovery and in the execution of quantum gates can be solved by the same general strategy, what we might call the quantum software strategy, where we, first of all, offline prepare a suitable quantum state, what we might call quantum software, and then we verify in some way that the preparation was done correctly. And we want to do that offline so that if something goes wrong, we can throw the state away and try again without causing damage to the data. And then we allow the verified software to come in contact with the data through the execution of some quantum gates, which may damage the software so that afterwards we have to discard it. But we achieve some operation on the data, either an error recovery step or the execution of a gate by using that software. So this is really the software vendor's dream. Every time we use the software, we have to throw it away, and then we have to either buy another copy or prepare it ourselves. Now, as for codes that can correct many errors, one way in which they can be constructed is to formulate a hierarchy of codes within codes. We can imagine using the five-qubit code that I described to take a single encoded qubit and embed it in a block of five. But suppose that each one of these five qubits, when examined more closely at higher resolution, is really not a single raw qubit, but again, a block of five encoded by the same method as before. And let's say each one of those five is really a block of five encoded by the same method. So each time we add another level to the hierarchy, we increase the dimension of the code block by another factor of five. But what we might gain in return is higher reliability. Since for failure to occur, we would have to have two boxes go bad at the top level. And for each one of those to go bad, there would have to be two faulty boxes at the next level down and so on. So as we add more levels to the hierarchy of codes, we can get better protection against errors. Actually, that's not completely obvious because of the overhead associated with doing a fault-tolerant protocol. If the probability of error every time we do an elementary quantum gate is too high, then if we try to perform gates on encoded data instead, things might actually get worse instead of better. And if we use a more intricate code with another layer of error correction, things might be worse still. But once the probability of error per gate, once our gate fidelity is below a certain threshold, or the fidelity is above a threshold of accuracy, the error probability is sufficiently small, then fault-tolerant protocols really do give an improvement in performance, and a gate acting on encoded data works better than a gate acting on raw data. And then if we add another level to the hierarchy, we can make things better still. So once our gate fidelity, or the probability of error per gate, is sufficiently small, something like 10 to the minus 4, we can, in principle, perform a long quantum computation with good reliability. So roughly speaking, you can interpret this number as the requirement that the decoherence time of the qubits should be at least 10 to the 4 times longer than the time needed to execute an elementary gate. Well, in order to conclude that we can really do robust quantum computation, there are various assumptions which I made which were not explicit. And actually, we need to make similar assumptions to show that robust classical computation is possible also. We want to assume that the error rate per qubit is actually a constant even as we add more and more qubits to our device, that it doesn't increase, that the errors in the elementary qubits are relatively weakly correlated, both spatially and in time, that we can perform parallel operation. Many qubits in the, are operated on by quantum gates in the same time step, so that we can control errors in different parts of the computer at the same time. And we need some kind of reusable memory, that is, the ability to erase our ancillas so that the entropy drawn from the data by the errors can be discarded. Now, there are additional assumptions that we make in order to actually get a number like 10 to the minus 4, which are helpful, but not essential for achieving robust quantum computation, but allow us to do it better. So one thing we might assume is that we can measure qubits fast, which might not be the case for all hardware implementations, that we can measure them as fast as we can perform a quantum gate. And we might also like to assume that we have a classical computer which is much faster than the quantum computer. So, for example, when we read out an error syndrome, we can quickly do classical processing to figure out how we should proceed to recover. And to get that number, I also assume that we can do non-local gates. This is a very unrealistic assumption, namely that even when the qubits are far apart from one another, we can perform a gate coupling those two qubits together with a fidelity independent of their separation. That certainly won't be true in practice. In making that assumption, we're optimistically supposing that we can find some way of designing our computer so that the qubits that will need to interact with one another are kept close to one another. So let me be an optimist and suppose in the rest of the talk that someone has provided me with some hardware that has these various nice features, that we can perform parallel operations as required, that we can measure qubits quickly, that we have a very fast classical computer to process measurement outcomes, that we have ancilla qubits around wherever we need them and we can erase them quickly, and I want to be able to arrange the qubits in three dimensions so each one of the qubits has a significant number of neighbors. But I will insist that all our gates are really local. Okay? And I'm going to argue that under these conditions, topological ideas point us toward a method which has good efficacy for controlling the errors in the quantum computer. So what does topology have to do with fault tolerance? The topological properties of an object are the properties that remain invariant when we smoothly deform the object. And when we're seeking a fault-tolerant quantum gate, that means we want the way that the gate acts on encoded states to remain invariant even if we deform the gate by introducing some noise. So we're led to seek physical interactions that have some topological character. And the prototype of that is the Aharnoff-Bohm effect. We know that if we transport an electron around a magnetic flux tube, its wave function acquires an Aharnoff-Bohm phase. And that phase is a topological property. If we deform the trajectory of the electron, the Aharnoff-Bohm phase is invariant as long as the winding number of the electron around the flux tube hasn't changed. Now, in some cases, if we have a system which has local excitations or defects, which have non-trivial Aharnoff-Bohm interactions, we can infer that the system must have some kind of robust ground state degeneracy. Now, here's an example. I have a two-dimensional system which has two types of edges and two types of excitations, marked in red and in green. The green excitations can be created and destroyed at the green edges. The red excitations can be created and destroyed at the red edges. So let's consider an operation which preserves the ground state, which is the state in which there are no defects, in which the green defect propagates from the south to the north. Call that R, and an operation, I call that G, an operation R, in which the red defect propagates from the west to the east. And if we perform first G, then R, then the inverse of G, and then the inverse of R, let's suppose that the green and red defects have non-trivial Aharonov-Bohm interactions. Then the effect of these performing these four operations in succession will be non-trivial, because this procedure can be deformed to one in which the world lines of the red particle and the green particle link with one another. So there's a non-trivial Aharonov-Bohm phase. And so these operations which preserve the ground state have a non-trivial algebra, and that means the manifold of ground states can't be one-dimensional. So guided by that observation, we can construct quantum error-correcting codes, as Kataya pointed out a few years ago. Let's imagine that we have qubits arranged on a two-dimensional lattice with a qubit corresponding to each one of the links of the lattice. And let's define a code space as the simultaneous eigenspace with eigenvalue 1 of a set of commuting operators. Operators associated with each site and each elementary cell or plaquette of the lattice. At a site, we have a product of x's acting on each one of the links that meet at the site. At a plaquette, we have a product of z's acting on each one of the links making up that plaquette. So these are mutually commuting. And since the check operators here are local, we can think of the instance in which the check operator has the value minus 1 as being a localized excitation in the code block, a kind of defect. And in fact, the code space that we've constructed is very much like the ground state of a certain gauge theory. Having a trivial site operator is like saying that there's no electric charge at that site. Having a trivial plaquette operator is like saying that there's no magnetic flux at a plaquette. And these site excitations or defects and the plaquette excitations have a non-trivial Aharonov-Bohm interaction, an Aharonov-Bohm phase of minus 1 when we carry one around the other. We can make a localized site excitation by acting on a chain of links with the Pauli operator Z, and then the excitation appears at the end of the chain. Or we can apply X to a chain of links at the dual lattice, and then there will be a plaquette excitation at the end of that chain. And if I allow a site excitation to propagate around a plaquette excitation, there's a non-trivial Aharonov-Bohm phase, because the red links and the black links overlap in an odd number of places. So there's a anti-commuting minus 1 that occurs. So if I ask what kinds of operations preserve the ground state, the state with no defects, that's our code space. Well, those are operations, let's say if I consider for now just products of z's, in which the links acted on by the z's have no boundary. And if I have an even number of z's, in other words, acting on each one of the sites, it's a cycle on the lattice, a chain that has no boundary. And there are two types of cycles. There are ones which are homologically trivial, and that means it's the boundary of something. And in that case, z's acting on all the black links can actually be expressed as a product of our check operators, products of z's acting on each one of the colored plaquettes. And therefore, this is a trivial operation. It's just a product of check operators, which in the code space all have the value plus 1, and it doesn't do anything. But there are also homologically non-trivial cycles, which wrap around the cycle of the torus, which I've represented here. I guess I forgot to say that it was a torus. It's a torus represented as a square with opposite sides identified. And this can't be expressed as just a product of the check operator, so although it preserves the code space, it acts in the code space in a non-trivial way. So we actually can construct a basis for operations that act in the code space, which preserve this ground state with no defects, which can be chosen to be a product of z's running around one of the two cycles of the torus. So you can think of that as a physical process in which a site defect winds around the cycle of the torus, and there's a corresponding encoded X, which preserves the code space, which you can think of as a process in which a plaquette defect winds around a cycle of the lattice. So it's kind of inconvenient to deal with the torus from an engineering perspective, so it's noteworthy that we can build interesting codes when we just have a planar surface with an interesting boundary. So, for example, consider this a square lattice, but with two types of edges, smooth edges and rough edges where there are hanging links. And then if I consider Z's acting on the black links, that actually produces an isolated defect at this site, or I consider X's acting on this chain of links that goes to the smooth edge, which produces an isolated plaquette excitation. And so now we have excitations which can actually run off to the boundary of the sample and disappear. So it's really just the situation I described a few minutes ago, where we have excitations which have non-trivial Laharnoff-Bohm interactions and can be created and destroyed at different boundaries. So we have a system again which has a non-trivial degeneracy. And we can take as a basis for operations acting in our code space processes in which a site defect goes from rough edge to rough edge, or a plaquette defect goes from smooth edge to smooth edge. Okay, so now let's suppose we want to use this type of code to protect quantum information. Errors are going to be introduced, like let's say X is acting on these red links. In order to make an inference about how the code block has been damaged, we're going to measure check operators, and that will reveal the positions of some defects, which are just these green sites which are at the boundary of the chain. But in this case, the syndrome information that we collect is highly ambiguous, because any chain that had the same boundary, if X has acted on that chain, would have produced the same syndrome. So I might make the inference that what actually occurred was that X has acted on the green links, and in order to reverse the damage, I apply X's to those links. My guess was wrong, but it's wrong in a harmless way because it was homologically correct. If X's are introduced on the red links, and then I apply recovery by applying X's to the green links, then altogether we've applied X's to a homologically trivial path, which acts in a trivial way on the code space. So we've completely removed all of the damage. On the other hand, if I had X errors introduced on the red links, I might mistakenly infer that the errors occurred on the green links and attempt to recover by applying X's to those links. And then the errors, together with my attempt at recovery, apply because the site defects are detecting the Z errors. So if Z's are actually introduced by the environment on the red links and I apply Z's to the green links, then altogether that's Z's applied to a homologically non-trivial path, which actually acts in a non-trivial way in the code space and so introduces an encoded error. Okay, so now if the error rate is relatively small and the errors are not strongly correlated, then typically the damaged links, the red links, will be fairly dilute, and that means the syndrome particles, the defects, will have tightly correlated positions. And so it should be relatively easy to make an inference, which is at least homologically correct, about how we should pair up the defects in order to recover from the damage. And in fact, there is a classical algorithm that's efficient that can be used if the error rate is low enough, which will allow us to recover successfully. So this is a system which looks like it ought to have an accuracy threshold. We ought to be able, in other words, if the error rate is low enough, to protect against a number of errors which scales linearly with the number of qubits in the block. But things aren't quite as simple as they might be, because when we make our measurements to diagnose where the defects are, sometimes the measurements are inaccurate. And so there are some apparent positions of defects which are actually phony just because we made measurement errors. And then it becomes a little bit less obvious how we should proceed with recovery in such a way that we're more likely to get rid of errors instead of adding more. Well, the general solution to inaccurate measurements is to increase the measurements until you have more confidence in the outcomes. So what we should imagine doing is performing a measurement of the syndrome, detecting the defects in a sequence of time steps, and recording the history of the measurement outcomes. So now we should be thinking about a three-dimensional lattice, but that was too hard to draw, so I compressed it to two dimensions, where now our qubits live on the plaquettes, and where on a given time slice two qubits meet, that's where we're measuring a syndrome to see if there's a defect there or not. If there is a defect in our measurement, we'll mark that link in green. What actually happened in this case was that errors occurred on the black links. And there are two types of errors. On the vertical links, those errors are just measurement errors. And that means that we, let's say in this case, thought there was a defect there because we made a mistake. But that's why there's a green line. But the vertical black line means that that was actually a faulty measurement and we shouldn't have gotten that outcome. And there are also errors on the horizontal links, which are actual errors in the qubits introduced during a round of syndrome measurement. Those are errors which can cause two defects to come together and annihilate, or for a pair of defects to be created, or for a defect to propagate from one side on the lattice to another side. Well, when we make our observations, we don't know where the black links are. We only know about the green measurement record. And our job is to make an inference based on that record about where the black chain is up to something that's homologically trivial. And if we can make that inference correctly, then we can protect against error. So although we don't know where the black links are, what we do know, what we do learn from our measurement record, is where the boundary of this black chain of links is. Because the black chains where the errors are has the same boundary as the green chain where we detect the defects. And so the issue is, if you consider a typical error that could occur, and then think about all the other errors which could have produced the same syndrome, that is, a chain which has the same boundary, if it's the case that, except for a negligible probability when the system is small, all of the chains that could have produced the same boundary are homologically equivalent to the actual error, then we can recover successfully. Okay? So how do we analyze this type of problem? Well, it actually turns out that at least if we go to a certain limit where we consider a two-dimensional lattice instead of a three-dimensional lattice, this is a well-studied problem. So let's consider the two-dimensional case where now I'm going to imagine that I have an Ising spin system. And that means on each one of the plaquettes, I'm putting the spins on plaquettes, I have a variable which takes values either plus one or minus one. And there are couplings between neighbors which can be either anti-ferromagnetic, favoring that the neighboring spins anti-align, or ferromagnetic, favoring that they align. And at random, I'll decide where the anti-ferromagnetic links are, which I've marked in red, in black, sorry. The ones favoring anti-alignment. And now I let the spins fluctuate thermally by introducing some finite temperature. And what that means is there will be some thermal excitations, which are domain walls, where the spins either anti-align at a ferromagnetic bond or align at an anti-ferromagnetic bond. And that domain wall chain is constrained to have the same boundary as the chain of anti-ferromagnetic links. So the thermal fluctuations just mean that we're letting the domain walls fluctuate subject to the constraint that they have the same boundary as the chain of anti-ferromagnetic links. And then we can ask, is the system magnetically ordered or not? The issue is whether there are large droplets of flipped spins. And in order to get a large droplet, the fluctuating chains, the red chains, need to be able to wander a long distance away from the quenched, fixed, randomly selected anti-ferromagnetic bonds. And that's exactly the problem we're interested in. Well, this model is called the random bond Ising model, since at random we decide whether the couplings are anti-ferromagnetic or ferromagnetic, and we select a sample where we randomly select the black bonds where the anti-ferromagnetic coupling is. And what we're interested in actually is a particular relation between the temperature that determines how the spins fluctuate and the probability P that determines the distribution of anti-ferromagnetic bonds. The reason that relation arises is that we want to select the fluctuating chains and the quenched chains that we fixed from the same ensemble for the links to appear with the same probabilities, both due to those thermal fluctuations and the quenched fluctuations. So this model has a phase diagram that's been studied, and when the probability of an anti-ferromagnetic link is small enough or the temperature is small enough, it is ferromagnetically ordered, and if we introduce enough anti-ferromagnetic bonds or a high enough temperature, it becomes disordered. And this relation between the temperature and the bond probability has actually been studied previously before too. It's called the Nishimori line of the phase diagram because Nishimori discovered that the model has particularly nice symmetry properties along that line. And so at least in a two-dimensional limit, which would be the appropriate thing to study if we had perfect syndrome measurement, so we were just looking at the positions of the defects and we knew exactly where they were, and now we wanted to know if there's a unique homology class of chains with that boundary, which occurs with non-negligible probability. Where that threshold of accuracy is, the boundary between being able to correct errors and not being able to correct errors, is just this critical point on the Nishimori line that separates the ferromagnetic and the disordered phase of the system. And it's known from numerical studies that the critical error probability is about 11%. And that means if we have perfect syndrome measurement, if the qubits get damaged and we measure the syndrome perfectly, we can recover successfully in the limit of a large system if the probability of error per qubit is less than 11%. But in the general case, we want to consider this three-dimensional system, which it turns out is not a Ising spin system, but something a little bit different. It's actually a gauge theory. And now the fluctuating chains are not domain walls, they're actually magnetic flux tubes. And when we put in the quenched fluctuations, that means we lay down magnetic monopoles at certain positions, which are places where magnetic flux tubes can end, and consider the fluctuating flux tubes constrained to end at those monopole positions. And then if the temperature is sufficiently high or the density of monopoles is high enough, then the magnetic flux tubes will fluctuate all over the place and the system will become magnetically disordered, and that's this phase over here. And if the monopole abundance is small and the temperature is small, then it stays magnetically ordered. And what corresponds to the difference between being able to correct errors and not being able to correct errors is this phase boundary along this Nishimori line where the quenched fluctuations and the thermal fluctuations are related in a specific way. Well, based on, now as far as I am aware, this model has never been studied before. I haven't seen it discussed anywhere. Based on preliminary numerical studies, it seems like the critical error probability is about 3%, and we have a rigorous bound saying that it's greater than 1%. So what that means is, if in each round of syndrome measurement, the probability of getting an incorrect syndrome is less than 1% at each site, and the probability of getting a new qubit error at each position is less than 1%, then in the limit of a large system, we can recover with a success probability of 1 and protect against errors. So this is kind of an interesting kind of quantum classical phase transition. We have a quantum low noise phase in which, although I haven't described how to do quantum gates, we discussed in the paper how to do them. So we can do robust quantum computation in the quantum phase. And in the noisy phase, we can actually simulate the system efficiently with a classical computer. And what we've learned is that this boundary between the quantum behavior and the classical behavior can actually be identified with the boundary between the magnetically ordered and the magnetically disordered phase of a certain three-dimensional gauge theory. Now we might want to know what this corresponds to in terms of what kind of fidelity we need for quantum gates in a quantum computer in order to protect against errors effectively. And to analyze that, we actually have to look at the details of the quantum circuits that are used to measure the syndrome. The circuits are nice and simple. That's the beautiful feature of this model. But the analysis is a little bit complicated because we have to worry about how errors get propagated by the circuits. And as a result, we can't get a precise number, just a bound. But we can say that if the probability of error each time we do a quantum gate is greater than 10 to the minus 4, then we can protect against errors effectively. Where, again, I remind you of the assumptions I'm making. All the gates are required to be local, But we assume we can perform many gates in parallel, that we can measure quickly, and that we have a very fast quantum, very fast classical computer to process our measurement outcomes. So these considerations lead us to a kind of sketch, a caricature of a possible quantum computer design, where, remember, we have a qubit encoded in a planar sheet of qubits, a protected qubit in each sheet. So we can make a big stack of such sheets, the blue sheets, and intersperse with them sheets of Ancilla qubits, which are used to control the errors in the logical information. I haven't told you how to do gates, but in fact, if I want to get the logical qubits to interact with one another, I can perform swap gates to move them through the stack, bring them into contact, and then perform gates. But I don't completely escape the need for some kind of quantum software. Somewhere in the stack, at various locations in the stack, there are little software factories that are used to prepare particular quantum states that are needed to implement some of the quantum gates that occur in our circuit. So I've described a way in which we can fight off the destructive effects of errors and decoherence. And as I promised you, it doesn't look that easy. In some ways, it's a little bit more like System A than System B. Is that inevitable? I don't know. We can at least dream of a quantum memory which achieves robustness through a more physical mechanism, which doesn't require active error correction. After all, that's how classical memory works. I can store a classical bit in the global alignment of a magnetic domain, and at finite temperature, there will be fluctuations which will cause little droplets of flip spins. But because those droplets have an energy cost, they don't get very big at low temperature, and the classical bit is robust. So in our system, we have a two-dimensional array, but where now it can be disordered by point-like particles. And what we need to do to protect the quantum information is prevent those particles from wandering far apart from one another. That's really what our recovery procedure did. If we could implement that physically, it would mean introducing some kind of attractive interaction among these defects that would prevent them from wandering away from one another. Maybe we can engineer a system like that someday. Okay, so I've told you something about quantum error correction and fault tolerance, and describe one of the ways in which topological ideas might provide us with some guidance in designing fault-tolerant protocols. I don't know, but it's my guess that if large-scale quantum computers are eventually constructed, topological ideas will have a very central role in the way they're designed. Thanks for your attention.
We have time for a few questions.
Mike.
Well, this is your engineering challenge. So I said I'll make optimistic assumptions about the hardware that you will provide me with and run with them. But I don't know how to build a machine that realizes those specifications. Well, there are certainly practical limits, but I'm not aware of any fundamental limit in principle that prevent us from integrating fast classical control in an array of qubits. Yeah, I didn't tell you about that, and because I decided I didn't have time. Preparing known encoded states is not that difficult, because we can start out with any state and we can measure the stabilizer operators, and then we can also measure one of the logical operations, like we want to get a state which is, an eigenstate of the encoded Z. We can measure all the stabilizer operators pretty easily. It's a little bit harder to measure the encoded Z, but there are ways of doing it, and we can prepare known states that way. If you want to take unknown quantum states and deposit them into the quantum memory, This is a little bit tricky because you actually want to start out with a small code block when you're introducing the state into the block when you're encoding it, because otherwise something will go wrong during the encoding when you don't have good protection. So what you have to do is start out with a little planar sheet and then gradually build up qubits around the edge until you have a well-protected logical qubit. Well, I know the sign of the effect. It gets better. I should emphasize that I was doing something non-local in this talk because I swept it under the rug of saying I had a fast classical computer. Now I know that there really is an algorithm which is efficient for doing a classical computation, but it actually requires, as its input, at least the way I describe things, the syndrome history for the whole block, which in the case where we have a very small error probability is a really big block. So I'm imagining I have fast classical communication and computation to bring all that data together and process it and send a signal out to tell my local controllers whether to apply an X or a Z to each one of the qubits. So there was a little bit of non-locality built in, but the trick was to make sure that all the non-locality was classical. It gets better. Maybe, and certainly, I don't have a better answer than that. Go to your real question, which is, what about non-local quantum processing?
I think the time for the first talk and questions has run out. Let us thank John again.